Hi, I'm Devin Pulaski, and before I jump into today's episode, I'd like to take a moment to offer words of support to everyone on the front lines of this pandemic. Whether you're a nurse or a doctor, an employee at a grocery store, someone who delivers packages, someone working in a factory or fulfillment center, or any one of the people that make our society function in the midst of a pandemic, I want to say thank you from the bottom of my heart. Sometimes it feels a little strange to make a radio show about video games when such a crisis is going on. But to me, games and play are what we need now more than ever before, no matter what age you are. When we're alone, games enable us ways to relax and unwind and explore and solve problems and be creative and to build things. They give us feelings of control and a sense of accomplishment. And many games allow us to share all these great things with other people, fostering a sense of community and belonging. Most of us can't be physically together right now, and while nothing can truly replace that, you can come pretty darn close in the virtual spaces found in many games. One of my goals with this show is to help introduce a world of games to people who don't know much about them or who aren't yet convinced that games are a source for good. But everyone is different, and even when I make recommendations for games to play on this show, they might not quite be the right choice for everyone. So if you're looking for something to play right now, reach out to me and I'll find you the perfect game. Just tell me what kinds of things you like to do or are interested in, as well as what kind of technology you have. And also, let me know what experiences you have with games, whether you play them all the time or not at all, or maybe you did when you were younger but haven't in decades. Or maybe you just play a few games on your phone, things like that. Also, do you have a game console? Or what about a phone or tablet, and what kind? What about a computer? Are you looking to play something on your own, or something that will be fun in a group? Any details you can give me will help me pick out the right thing for you. Just go to thecuriousgamer.org and hit the contact button and write me a note. I promise I'll get back to you really quick. Again, that's thecuriousgamer.org. All right, let's start the episode. This is The Curious Gamer, a show about the culture, design, and joy of games. I'm Devin Pulaski. Fantasy. It's something many of us yearn for in normal times. But in troubled times, caused by a pandemic, many of us find fantasy essential. Fantasy, in all its strangeness and absurdities, enables us a way to escape anything that ails us. The fear of uncertainty, the confines of our homes, the anxiety of getting sick, or the economic collapse of our society. Naturally, I like to take refuge inside the fantasies found in video games. But out of the hundreds, maybe thousands of video games I've played over the decades, there is one world that I return to and that has inspired me more than almost any other. This is a special game, not just to me, but to millions of people around the world. I'm talking about Final Fantasy VII. Final Fantasy VII is a game remembered and returned to not so much for its gameplay, but for its characters, its rich world and storytelling, and the bold, beautifully composed music. I play Final Fantasy VII almost every other year, and I've done so since I was very young. But right now is a particularly special time to revisit Final Fantasy VII. On April 10th, 2020, 23 years after the game's initial release, a complete overhaul of the original game made its debut, a project fittingly titled Final Fantasy VII Remake. The world of the original game has been reimagined using today's cutting-edge game production techniques, and it expands upon the original game with new ideas, stories, and characters, and it's informed by decades of evolution in game design. It's such a massive project that it has been split into multiple games. This first game only covers what was the first few hours of the original game, but stretches that experience into roughly 40 to 60 hours of playtime. But today, I'd like to celebrate the legacy of the original Final Fantasy VII, and to pinpoint why it deeply affects the minds and hearts of players the world over. I'd like to explore why, even after 15 numbered Final Fantasy games and dozens more in spin-offs and sequels, the seventh iteration, in particular, has an extra strong grasp over the world's imagination. Typically, my goal with this show is to share games that anyone could enjoy, games that are accessible even if you don't regularly play games. But Final Fantasy VII is not one of those games, even if it is one of the most played and most loved games ever created. There are certain aspects to the game that make it too technical or simply outside the comfort zone for many people. Nevertheless, I think it's worth sharing titles that have forever shifted the landscape of games. Just like with films, books, and music, understanding the landmark artwork created in the years before can inform the works of today and in the future. And look, I'll be straight with you. This episode is a bit of a rambling mess, kind of like my first episode where I talked about Sonic the Hedgehog for way too long. I know, it's more enjoyable to listen to a concise, well-edited thing than a long rambling thing, but let's be honest, you already have your headphones or smart speaker on and you're doing the dishes or folding laundry or something. Plus, you're probably sheltering in place, so it's not like you're doing anything else. Trust me, the next episode I have planned will be much more focused. All right, buckle up, friends. It's time to get deep in the weeds. The year is 1997. The latest in the beloved series of Final Fantasy games has just been released for a new console called the Sony PlayStation. A blitz of marketing has heavily advertised this mystifying and dizzyingly beautiful game, helping to ensure that almost every game-playing person at the time not only knows of this game's existence, but is made aware of the game's sheer scale and ambition.
More than 200 animators and programmers. A multi-million dollar production. Over 2 years in the making. And a cast of thousands. They said it couldn't be done in a major motion picture. They were right. Final Fantasy VII.
On store shelves, players would see this game housed in a large case containing not one, not two, but three CD-ROM discs, which helped telegraph just how massive an experience you were about to embark on if you bought it. Once players would pop the first disc into their PlayStation, they retreated to the iconic melody that plays before every Final Fantasy game, a song known simply as Prelude. This song, and all the music of every Final Fantasy to this point, was composed by Nobuo Uematsu. This man is one of my heroes. Uematsu's songs are etched into my very soul. The melodies he's composed over decades of games are always rich with raw energy and heart-wrenching emotion. For many years now, the music of Final Fantasy is played annually by live orchestras in cities across the world, and I was fortunate to see him perform in person once before. Uematsu's music has, and will forever, inform how I compose my own songs. For the rest of this episode, sometimes I'll play the original music from this game, like the song you're hearing now. These were made using the limited synthesizer hardware available on the PlayStation in 1997. But because this game's music is so beloved, much of it has been remade several times for the various Final Fantasy spin-off games, movies, and media created over the decades. And this is especially true for the recently released Final Fantasy VII Remake. But while my heart is forever bonded to the original tracks, I concede that, to many listeners, the updated versions played with real instruments will be the favorite tracks to listen to. And man, listening to how Uematsu's score goes from this to this. That's pretty awesome to hear for longtime fans. Alright, now let's go back to what it was like for players to start up this mysterious new game in 1997. Players get to the main menu and select New Game. The screen goes dark. Stars appear. The camera bobbing left to right strangely, while a droning sound is heard in the background. Then, stars turn into green mist. Suddenly, the face of a young woman appears. The 3D graphics rendering her image are unlike anything seen before in a game. She's crouched over something in the alleyway. She stands, walking towards the main city street as the camera cinematically pulls back. Suddenly, a car cuts the woman off, and a flurry of traffic and pedestrians crowd the view. The camera soars farther and farther away to reveal an industrial metropolis. A gargantuan tower at the center of the city zooms past your view. The camera finally slows its ascent, revealing an awe-inspiring city. The Final Fantasy VII logo flashes on screen, but then the camera begins moving once more, slowly returning to the ground level. Suddenly, there are film-like jump cuts that show a speeding train. Soon, the shots of the train and the main camera's return to the ground merge into a single shot as the train slows to a stop in front of two security guards. Suddenly, a man jumps off the train. A guard rushes in to subdue them, but the man throws him over his shoulder, slamming the guard to the ground. Next, a woman rushes off the train and gives the other guard a swift kick to the stomach. Two more men rush off the train. One of them has a towering presence, and something merged to his right arm. Finally, the game's protagonist, the character you control, appears. He's a thin man with blonde hair, and he jumps off the train, landing in style. The large man turns to you and issues a command. "Come on, newcomer. Follow me." It takes you a moment to realize, but suddenly it becomes clear that it is your turn to act. The lines between movie and gameplay have been hidden so well that it almost feels wrong to be able to control something so cinematic. And with that, the roller coaster that is Final Fantasy VII is off and running. This opening sequence of Final Fantasy VII demonstrates the confidence of the creator's vision and direction throughout the game's production. But it took a decade of lessons learned over six previous games to get to this point. The original Final Fantasy was created in 1987 by a Japanese game designer named Hironobu Sakaguchi and developed by a company called Square, known today as Square Enix. Final Fantasy falls under a genre of games called role-playing games, or RPGs. But this was a risky choice to develop at the time, since there weren't many other RPGs to look to for inspiration, and many of the ones that did exist received poor sales. Nevertheless, Sakaguchi and his team had a vision, and they pressed on, and the success of their first game ushered in an entire fantasy franchise that would be anything but final. popular myth is that the name Final Fantasy was chosen because, well, if the game failed, Square would be in such dire straits that the company would have to close. Sakaguchi confirmed the real reason a few years ago. He said the team wanted the game to have the English abbreviation of FF, which would translate to the pleasing-sounding FUFU in Japanese. This Roman numeral-style spelling would carry on throughout the rest of the series, like Final Fantasy VII being abbreviated to FFVII, or the 15th game abbreviated to FFXV, and so on. The first Final Fantasy was released on the Nintendo Entertainment System, or NES, to critical and commercial success in Japan in 1987. It was then localized and released in North America in 1990. The game gives you control of a party of four heroes as you go on an adventure throughout a medieval fantasy world, exploring towns and dungeons, fighting monsters and warriors, finding treasure, casting magic spells, collecting weapons, and so on. Like most all RPGs at the time and to this day, it's heavily inspired by the gameplay and aesthetic of Dungeons & Dragons, and of other popular fantasy stories like The Lord of the Rings. Final Fantasy I features another RPG staple, turn-based combat. This is also borrowed from how Dungeons & Dragons manages combat, where the Dungeon Master gives you an enemy to fight and players roll dice to see how their attacks pan out. In RPGs, combat is pretty similar to the rolling dice approach. When your heroes encounter an enemy, you don't fight it by mashing a button to swing your sword or magical staff in real time, like you would in most action games. Instead, the game has a more strategic focus. Each character takes turns with their actions. When it's your hero's turn, you choose what to do from a menu, like attack with your weapon, or cast a magic spell, or use a helpful item. Then you watch as the actions play out and you see how successful, or ineffective, your plan was. Admittedly, this is one of those love it or hate it things that can make RPGs like Final Fantasy difficult for some people to get into. Final Fantasy's gameplay was at the cutting edge of its time, but it was the game's story, music, and general atmosphere that elevated it into a memorable experience, a quality true of every installment of Final Fantasy. And the first game was born out of an era where telling a story in a video game was still a novel pursuit. The game may have had a simple good versus evil tale, but it was proof that games could deliver narrative and emotion and meaningfully incorporate these alongside gameplay. And it's this pioneering commitment to narrative that inspired many other game developers in the decades ahead. Riding the high of the first game, Square went on to develop Final Fantasy II and III, which were also released on the NES, each game adding new wrinkles to the established formula. Then came Final Fantasy IV, V, and VI, which were released on the Super Nintendo, or SNES. With each new Final Fantasy, the developers were able to showcase their deepening mastery of creating graphically rich worlds, evocative music, and more nuanced, competent, and engaging stories and characters. Each of these games continued the tradition of using a medieval high fantasy art style, occasionally mixing in present-day or even sci-fi elements as well, giving the games an iconic style that put it in a league of its own. And here's something that often surprises people. Every Final Fantasy game has completely different stories, plots, characters, and worlds, and even the game mechanics are largely tweaked or even overhauled between releases. This means that when you start up Final Fantasy VI, for example, you don't need to play Final Fantasy 1 through 5 to know what's going on. This makes it easy to jump into the series at just about any number. On top of that, there are several elements and themes that carry between every Final Fantasy, such as creatures and the names of various objects and pieces of lore. While every Final Fantasy may be very different from the last, there's a through line tying each of these games together, rewarding longtime fans each time they dip into the latest entry. The sixth installment of Final Fantasy in particular was considered a major step forward for all of video games, firmly cementing the series as one of the most important in the entire medium. And at the time, it was hard for anyone to imagine how the team could take this series any further. Final Fantasy VI released in 1994, and up to this point, all Final Fantasy games were exclusive to Nintendo's NES and SNES game consoles. But when it came to the Nintendo 64, the successor to the SNES, Square decided it was time to move on and bring Final Fantasy to a new gaming platform, the Sony PlayStation. The PlayStation used a CD-ROM disc system to play its games, while the Nintendo 64 continued to use cartridges, similar to game consoles that came before it. This severely limited the amount of digital storage N64 games could have. Square knew that in order to outdo their work on Final Fantasy VI, their next game would have to reach beyond anything attempted before, meaning there could be no compromises on the hardware. And Sony, eager to make a name for themselves among the established gaming giants of Nintendo and Sega, needed a blockbuster hit game to prove that they were a serious threat. The team at Square wanted to harness cinema-quality visuals made with cutting-edge CGI and create a game world that was bursting with so many details that players would have to spend hundreds of hours to uncover them all. And since the technology powering this new game was revolutionary, the team decided to also go in bold new directions with their stories and characters, this time ditching the high fantasy medieval aesthetic in favor of something more modern. For 3 years, the team poured their heart and soul into their creation, and even before their work on the game was complete, the team knew that what they were making was a work of seismic importance to the entire medium of interactive entertainment. And thus, Final Fantasy VII was born, throwing players directly into the future with a bold cinematic opening. As the main character, Cloud, leaps off the train, it felt like video games as a whole were leaping into uncharted territory. Since visuals are such an important aspect of this game, let me paint a clear picture of what it actually looks like. First, there's the massive city, made almost entirely in shades of gray and black steel. The city is called Midgar. It looks a little bit like any major city on present-day Earth, but peppered with elements that make it seem at once a little futuristic, but also a little old-fashioned, a style meant to enhance the themes of the game's story. The city layout of Midgar is shaped like a giant pizza. Each district is like a slice of the pizza, tied together by the gargantuan, ominous tower at the center. At the outer ring of Midgar are various factory-like spires. Each of them is spewing some sort of industrial, smoky byproduct. Then there are the characters. First, the protagonist, a young man named Cloud Strife. Cloud has impossibly styled spiky blonde hair. He's seen wearing a sleek, dark, bluish-purple military garb. And while he's a pretty thin guy, he can effortlessly wield a comically large blade, called the Buster Sword. On the game's box, Cloud is seen staring down Midgar, his hand at the ready on his sword. It is as if he's ready to take on the entire city itself. Final Fantasy VII, as many video games are, has a target audience of young men, and one of its primary ways of accomplishing this goal is to highlight its promise of adrenaline-pumping action, like that of a Hollywood blockbuster. I played the game a few years after it came out when I was 11 years old. It didn't take much to catch my interest at that age. Cool-looking guy with a sword? Sure, sign me up. But past this low-hanging fruit is a game with far more interesting themes and ideas. Final Fantasy VII can take you around 40 to 60 hours to complete just the main story, and it's filled with numerous complicated, often convoluted plot points. Rather than explain it all, let me just give you some compelling highlights from the introduction. At the game's onset, Cloud and a band of warriors are storming a giant industrial tower, one of many that surround the city of Midgar. These towers are called Mako reactors, and their purpose is to harvest a glowing liquid extract from the planet called Mako. Mako is a mysterious substance, often described as the lifeblood of the planet. Think of it as something like a more mystical and spiritual version of oil, or natural gas, or some other fossil fuel. Right away, the game introduces its first villain, the all-powerful, all-consuming corporation known as Shinra. See, Shinra has figured out a way to harvest Mako from the planet and turn it into a plentiful energy source. Doing so has emboldened the company with tremendous profits, resources, and even socio-political power and influence. Shinra used their wealth to build Midgar, the largest city on the planet, and to run the city as a company, a government, and even a military. Shinra's power extends outward to most every other city on the planet, where the company has erected various Mako reactors and other infrastructure beneficial to the company. In doing so, they've not only exploited the planet's most precious resource, they've also put the planet in considerable danger. What's worse is that they've also exploited anyone that can further the company's ambition, especially people in poverty who are otherwise disadvantaged. Think of Shinra as a few ticks removed from the likes of Amazon, Google, Facebook, or Apple. I know what some of you might be thinking. This is the sort of capitalist dystopia nightmare story that feels like a message more palatable for audiences in the year 2020 than it did in 1997. That brings us back to our heroes. The protagonist, Cloud, is a mercenary hired by a group called Avalanche. Avalanche is headed up by a hulking man named Barrett. Barrett curiously has half of his right arm missing, and it's been replaced with a little Gatling gun. Barrett has a burning hatred for Shinra, so you can guess where he spends most of his time pointing his gun arm. Barrett and his Avalanche team have a simple mission. Infiltrate Mako reactors, plant a bomb, and blow them to smithereens. By doing this, they believe they're helping to save the planet. Since Mako is the planet's lifeblood, the more Shinra takes, the more harm is done to the planet. With controller in hand, you guide Cloud through the depths of the first Mako reactor. Together with Cloud's giant sword and Barrett's gun arm, you fight off Shinra's soldiers, robotic guards, and other dangerous enemies. Another tool at your disposal are glowing magical orbs called materia. When one of your characters holds these, they can cast useful magic, like fireballs and lightning bolts, or a spell that heals you when you take too much damage. Despite being frequently thrown into battle, there isn't non-stop action. A lot of chatter occurs as you make your way through the bowels of the reactor, and you quickly learn about each member of your team. Barrett constantly barks orders at you, often showing his skepticism of Cloud and his abilities, and makes frequent reference to the fact that Cloud was once a member of Shinra's military. Cloud, on the other hand, plays the cool, collected, tough guy approach, shrugging off Barrett's commands with sarcasm and indifference. While Barrett and the other Avalanche crew talk about how important their mission is to saving the planet, Cloud gives the same blank statement. I don't care about you guys, and I don't care about the planet. I'm just here for the money. You spend half hour to an hour of the game's opening fighting through the reactor, battling your way through Shinra's traps and guards, setting the bomb, and escaping the explosion just in time. Your crew regroups and reflects on what they've done, how they hope that what they did made a difference, and how killing many people, even innocent ones, is the tough pill they'll have to swallow for the greater good of saving the planet. On their return home, Avalanche boards another train, this time full of civilian passengers. They try to blend in as normal citizens, listening in to talk about the explosion. Some passengers say that they know Avalanche is behind it, and what they're doing is noble and heroic. Others say Avalanche is just a bunch of terrorists who put people in needless jeopardy. When I was 11 years old, I didn't pick up on how Final Fantasy VII is a game with blatant commentary on eco-terrorism and the dangers of unchecked capitalism. I mean, I was just here for the cool guy with a sword and the fun and stylish battles and the incredible graphics and music. Even so, at that age, I still knew that what I was playing was unlike any game I had encountered before. But while the opening mission may have planted this idea in my head, it was actually a specific moment during the quiet aftermath of the battle on the train ride home that cemented why this game was so special. Remember when I said that the city of Midgar is like a pizza? It's actually more like two pizzas stacked on top of each other. As the city got bigger, Shinra built a top layer plate over the bottom layer of the city. So while the Avalanche crew waits in one of the train cabins, Cloud looks out the window and comments on how unsettling it is to see a city in the sky, referencing the top plate. Barrett tells Cloud this development has caused the people at the bottom to suffer in various ways, such as air pollution caused by the upper plate, as well as the creation of a literal upper and lower class society. Cloud then wonders aloud why everyone doesn't just move to the upper plate, the kind of blanket statement some people often utter aloud, like, why don't homeless people just get a job? But Barrett tells Cloud that people probably don't move because they can't afford it. Cloud stares out the window once more, lost in thought. Then he says, I get it. No one lives in the slums because they want to. It's like this train. It can't run anywhere except where its rails take it. The camera then cuts to the exterior of the train as it races around the dark underbelly of the city, the graphics jumping to incredibly high fidelity. Tying this moment together is the soundtrack underscoring the somber, ponderous mood of this moment. It was this scene, the quiet yet cinematic moment of melancholy reflection, and not the bombastic battle of the beginning, that truly captured my imagination. I suddenly realized that this wasn't some cookie-cutter fairy tale fantasy quest where you slay a dragon and save a castle. These were people fighting an oppressive corporation, one that profits from a natural resource, endangers the planet, and exploits the disadvantaged. These heroes were stuck in a city where the rich get to reside in the safe part of town while everyone too poor or unfortunate were stuck in the polluted and dangerous place below. And the characters you were playing weren't knights in shining armor. They all had selfish ambitions and argued with each other. They blew things up in the name of the greater good, but in doing so took countless lives, blurring the lines between good and evil. Barrett had a sailor mouth, regularly cursing out everyone, while Cloud clearly had some sort of shady past. The urge to while the hours away and unravel the threads of this game's world is irresistible, and at this point, less than 1% of the game's content has been seen thus far. Each pizza slice-shaped neighborhood of Midgar doesn't have a name. They're simply called Sector 1, Sector 2, etc., further illustrating Shinra's autocratic approach to the populace it governs. The train carrying our heroes makes its final stop in Sector 7, the district where Avalanche resides, and they retire to a bar that acts as the group hideout. Suddenly, a little girl rushes up to Barrett. In an unexpected twist, the grumpy man with a gun for an arm joyously emotes and picks her up, twirls her around, and puts her on his shoulders. Turns out this girl is his daughter, Marlene. Then we meet the third main character of the game, a woman named Tifa. Tifa and Cloud are childhood friends, and she's the one that signed Cloud onto Avalanche's cause when he makes an unexpected stop in Midgar. Tifa and Cloud share a moment alone, but the following scenes raise questions of the nature of their relationship, whether they were once lovers or simply childhood friends. It's also murky as to what Cloud is doing in Midgar in the first place, or why he quit his past life as a soldier, and why he's accepting low pay for dangerous mercenary work. In addition to adding interesting threads to the narrative, it is in these scenes that Final Fantasy VII starts to question a lot of the character stereotypes it has relied on thus far. Let's start with Barrett, who is a black character, which was and still is a rarity in RPGs. up to this point, you could accuse Barrett of being a racist caricature, like he's a Mr. T knockoff, complete with raging dialogue and a gun as his primary weapon. But then, Barrett's bravado melts away when he sees his daughter. Suddenly, his fight for the planet feels bigger than himself, that he's doing it to provide a better future for his child. These moments also deepen Barrett's mystery. Where is Marlene's mother? Why is Barrett raising her alone? And why does he have a gun arm anyway? These scenes also expose cracks in Cloud's tough guy facade. Not only do we see moments of vulnerability from his childhood, we also see the falsehoods of his I don't care attitude when he pivots to support Tifa and Avalanche's mission. Throughout the rest of the game, the evolution of Cloud's character could be construed as the deconstruction of toxic masculinity. And then there's Tifa. Similar to Barrett, it's easy to accuse Tifa as a caricature, specifically a sex symbol. She sports a miniskirt and a tight-fitting tank top, and seems to serve primarily as Cloud's love interest at first. And while Avalanche is off on their missions, it seems Tifa stays back and takes care of the homestead. But then, the following day, Tifa announces she's joining you in the fight, which she does quite often to aid Avalanche in their goals. In almost every RPG, before and after Final Fantasy VII, playable women characters are often relegated to the role of support. They typically can't wield strong weapons or do much damage, but they can cast healing magic or other spells that aid the male characters. But the opposite is true for Tifa, as she is a highly proficient martial artist. She doesn't rely on swords or guns. Her fists are the only weapons she needs. And as she travels with you, the game puts distance between the idea of her and Cloud getting together anytime soon. She exists as a rare leading woman who enjoys the physical might typically reserved for male roles, while also not having to discard all shades of femininity. Aside from her physical appearance, Tifa exudes depth and nuance that gradually unspools over this lengthy journey. With Tifa on your team, you now have a party of three. The game does not suggest that one character is stronger than the other. You can make Tifa fight on the front lines, while Cloud and Barrett hang back with supportive magic. Or you can go for a balanced approach, distributing the roles of attack and support evenly between the three. As a player, it's up to you to decide what roles they should play in the fights ahead. Thus is the delicate balance between the game's predetermined story and the nuances of player agency over this narrative. And this balance is the glue that keeps the player deeply engaged over dozens of hours in this adventure. For all the praise and sheer deference I offer this game, let me take a step back and admit that Final Fantasy VII is ridiculous. It makes this known even before you pick up the controller, with its box art of an anime-styled pretty boy carrying a comically huge sword and who teams up with a guy who has a gun for an arm. As if I needed more evidence, let me summarize the next 6 to 8 hours of the game. First, you blow up another reactor, then Cloud is separated during the explosion. Then you meet a woman named Aerith, who is the next main character in the game. She's on the run from Shinra's version of the CIA. So you go on to explore the slums of Midgar. You get sucked into an intense red light district. You dress Cloud up as a woman and help overthrow the local crime lord. You battle monsters in a sewer, and you witness how Shinra demolishes an entire section of their city in order to crush Avalanche while also using their control over the media to turn this moment into propaganda against Avalanche. But it doesn't stop there. Next, you storm 70 floors of Shinra's headquarters. You discover the president of Shinra is murdered by a guy who carries his own comically large sword. You fight the president's son, who just took over the company. You meet a talking lion, and then you learn that Shinra is attempting to use an alien life form to run crazy experiments, and that Aerith is actually part of a near-extinct human-like race. All of this culminates in an epic motorcycle chase where you escape the city. Phew! And if that wasn't enough of a roller coaster, suddenly you realize that when you escape Midgar, that wasn't the end of the game, but simply the end of the game's first chapter. For the next 40 to 60 hours, your quest turns into a globe-trotting adventure where you're trying to stop a man who becomes a demigod and who threatens to destroy the entire planet after he summons a giant meteor to crash into it. Also, while I've talked much about how this game was a major step forward in video game graphics, the game looks positively archaic by today's standards. Your characters look like stiff action figures in cutscenes and in battle, and the character models used when you're simply walking around look almost like Lego characters with blocky appendages and static expressions. So much of Final Fantasy VII, or any Final Fantasy for that matter, can be accused of being silly, even cheesy and shallow, like the unedited ramblings of a teenager throwing the entire kitchen sink into a convoluted mess of a fictional tale. But somehow, this game manages to transcend its outlandish trappings and embed itself into your imagination. The game does this, for starters, by enveloping you with luxurious scenery that, even if it comes off as ridiculous, is nonetheless awe-inspiring because of how no other game looks quite as amazing. Once it has your attention, it hooks you with an infectious soundtrack. Then it throws you into the world as an active participant, giving you tools and abilities that are bursting with creative energy, asking you to give up your disbelief and join the fight. But most importantly, the game sets up permanent residence in your mind by including moments that forego the fantasies and spectacle, moments that surprise you with their raw honesty and emotional competence. The most famous example of this in Final Fantasy VII comes from the fact that one of your beloved characters is only with you for part of the journey. At the conclusion of the first disc of Final Fantasy VII, someone very dear to your team is tragically murdered. The game spends dozens of hours carefully bonding you to this person, making them effortlessly likable, only to take them away. This character is not magically brought back to life later in the tale. They are gone for good. In a medium of entertainment largely regarded as adolescent and frivolous, having a moment like this with such raw emotion redefined what was possible in video game storytelling. Because losing a character in a game isn't quite the same as other media. When it happens in Final Fantasy VII, the other characters erupt into rage and tears and confusion, much like characters would in a movie scene or in a book. But you, as the player, have your own feelings of loss too. After all, you've just spent dozens of hours assuming the role of this person. You guided them through both joy and hardship. You invested time and effort into making them stronger and to overcome adversity. When this person is gone, it not only impacts your experience with the narrative, but also your experience as a player, as an active participant in this world. After this person is gone, your goal to finish Final Fantasy VII becomes personal. Upon completing their masterpiece, Square started work right away on the next Final Fantasy. In keeping with tradition, Final Fantasy VIII would have all new characters, worlds, and stories, as would Final Fantasy IX and X, and so on. Each title played and loved by swaths of new and returning fans of the series. Even so, there was a particular and persistent hunger for VII. It went on to sell well over 11 million copies, as well as inspire various spin-off games, cameos of the game's characters in other games, as well as a cutting-edge CGI feature film in 2005. And now, 23 years later, the game has received the first chapter of a true reimagining of the original tale in the form of Final Fantasy VII Remake, which has already received near universal critical praise. While I'm glad Remake has lived up to the expectations, it is not a replacement for the original. Because once in a blue moon, a video game manages to recalibrate the entire industry, forcing all other games that come after it to heed its design, its lessons, and its impact on audiences around the world. Final Fantasy VII is one of those games, forever shaping our expectations of a game's narrative, its cinematic ambitions, its ability to captivate through image and sound, and most importantly, to enable us to inhabit a fantasy where we play compelling roles, where the story moves forward only when we take up the controller and make it so. Curious Gamer is written, produced, and voiced by me, Devin Pulaski. Please subscribe to the show on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts, and watch the show on YouTube. Also, I composed some of the music in this episode, but the rest was composed by the brilliant Nobuo Uematsu, as well as a few other talented musicians who assisted with the soundtrack to Final Fantasy VII Remake. So, it really, really helps the show out if you could leave a 5-star review or share the show with a friend you would think would be interested. You can do this and learn more about the show at thecuriousgamer.org. And don't forget, if you're looking for something to play right now, please don't hesitate to drop me a note. I promise I'll help you find the perfect game to play. Putting together a list like that for someone is actually one of my favorite things to do. So again, hit the contact button at thecuriousgamer.org. Thank you for listening, and thank you to all the people making our society function during this time. And remember this, no matter what you're doing, whether you're feeling up or down, you're never too old to enjoy your life and play.